My name's Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and I'm very happy to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I think most of you are familiar that this is an ongoing program, and I invite you, if you're not familiar with it, to get online and check it out. It's a great program with lectures each week. Couple of announcements for the big weekend ahead of us. This is the weekend for Modern Till Midnight. I invite you to check the website for all the details and times. I won't take time to run through all of that. There are scheduled tours throughout the evening. Of course, you can get the lineup of the bands on the website and more. So I invite you to do that. Also of note is our regularly scheduled Sundays with the Modern that I've mentioned each week. They've been incredible. They've been just amazing. Many of them have focused on the Ed Ruscha exhibition, but this coming week we have the pleasure of having Teresita Fernandez here to talk about her own work, which of course is what is featured in our upcoming Focus exhibition that, while open for Modern Till Midnight, officially opens to the public on Sunday. So in a way, you'll be the first to hear, and you can hear it directly from the artist. So again, meet at 1 p.m. You can check at the info desk to find out if everybody's going to meet in the lobby or, in fact, back where the Focus exhibition is held in the back gallery. Let's see. And then, of course, there is next Tuesday with artist Alex Hubbard. That is, in fact, our last Tuesday evening for the spring series. We'll begin again in September for the fall 2011 series, so I invite you to come next week to hear from Alex. Tonight, we are so fortunate to have curator Dan Cameron here to speak on his upcoming projects and other matters of passion. Dan was kind to take time out of his unbelievably busy schedule to be here. I was a little shocked when he accepted the invitation, but elated. As the founder and artistic director of U.S. Biennial, which organizes the Prospect New Orleans Biennial and related exhibitions. He is currently working on Project 2 and just opened The World According to New Orleans at Ballroom Marfa, which looks like an incredible show. From 2007 through 2010, he served as Director of Visual Arts for the Contemporary Arts Center in New Orleans, where he presented solo projects by artist Luis Cruz as a Seda, and Tony Fair, somebody we're very familiar with here, and Peter Saul, as well as the group exhibition Something from Nothing, Make It Right, previously on Piety, Interplay, and Hot Up Here. Before New Orleans, Dan was senior curator at the New Museum from 1995 to 2006, where he organized, where he was recognized for curating groundbreaking survey and new work exhibitions, including that of Teresita Fernandez, which I think is very interesting, in 2001. And in fact, I was talking to Dan today, and his history with Teresita goes back even before that. I think pretty much right out of grad school for her. So he was an active participant in her early career. His reputation as a curator and scholar have made Dan an obvious choice for honored and challenging positions such as artistic director for the 8th Istanbul Biennial titled Poetic Justice, and in 2003, and then he also is co-organizer for the 10th Taipei Biennial Dirty Yoga in 2006. Since 2002, Dan has served as senior curator for Next Wave Visual Art at BAM, which is the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where he organizes an annual exhibition of emerging Brooklyn-based artists. Since 2006, he has taught on the MFA faculty at SVA in New York, the School for Visual Arts. And in 2010, he was guest professor for International Curator course in Kwangju Biennial in South Korea, which I think is a fascinating project. He was just filling me in a little bit on that. By all reports, Dan is a courageous champion of art and artist. It seems fair to assume that it is such compassion that has directed his socially conscious career path in art, something that I think will be apparent in tonight's presentation, Reclaiming a City Through Art. So please join me in welcoming Dan Cameron.
Terry, thank you so much. Good evening, everyone. It's really a pleasure and an honor to be here. I love the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. I've been here many times. I don't think you need to be reminded. It's one of the most beautiful museums in the United States. And I just wish I could take your current Ed Ruscha program and fold it up and put it in my pocket and take it home with me. So thank you so much for inviting me to be here. I have been a curator for 30 years, and in the arc of my development as a curator, I feel like I've kind of gone from one stage of ignorance to another stage of somewhat qualified ignorance. I think that my formative relationship in many ways was with the New Museum in New York. For those of you who don't know the museum, it was started in the mid-70s by Marcia Tucker, who prior to that that brave effort to start a museum out of whole cloth, was the chief curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art. She organized a Richard Tuttle retrospective that got her fired because at that moment in time, little unstretched, bleached, monochromatic canvases on the wall were just deemed far too wild for the diet of museum goers. So Marcia was out on the street and within 18 months had formed New York's first Museum of Contemporary Art, as strange as that might seem. I began working with the New Museum on and off in the early 80s, right after I came to New York from college directly. And I feel that what Marcia really taught me as a curator was that sooner or later, your own journey in life and your professional trajectory as a curator will merge. As far as you try to keep them apart from each other, it's useless. It's a futile effort. And I must say that that's really been the lesson for me, or the subtext of the last 5 years of my work, when I've been almost entirely devoted to creating the largest biennial of international art in the United States for the city of New Orleans, which when I first thought of the idea seemed rather counterintuitive to many of the people who still remembered fresh images of the catastrophe of New Orleans after Katrina, when the levees broke and gave way and flooded 80% of the city in a matter of just a few hours, causing the largest single evacuation of a major urban area in the entire history of the United States. Thousands of people lost their lives. Many, many billions of dollars of property damage ensued. And I think that future generations and historians will be talking long after we're gone about what actually happened, both leading up to and during and in the aftermath of Katrina, and why the city was left the way it was left. My story with New Orleans, and I'm going to not give you the visuals right away because I think a little bit of background will become helpful later on when we're all just drawn into the details. I visited New Orleans in 1987 for the first time. My career as a curator was just starting to take off. I had organized my first large-scale European museum exhibition, and curating is a little like jazz, at least when it comes to Europe, which is that if you can get a foothold in the old country, you can keep working for a very long time. And so I found that that year, as I was shuttling back and forth to Barcelona and Madrid, which was where this exhibition called El Arte y Su Doble took place at the Fundación La Caixa, I found myself invited by the artist Peter Halley, who was then very much a part of the East Village art scene, to come to New Orleans. Peter had gotten his MFA degree from the University of New Orleans in the early 80s. He noticed that I was also a part-time musician, a slight avocation that I have now retired. But at that moment, he said, "You should really come to New Orleans because I just know you would love it." And my opening at the Arthur Roger Gallery is coinciding with Jazz Fest. And I basically asked him what a Jazz Fest was, ignorant me. And he said, "Just come along. It's a junket. Don't ask any questions. You'll have a good time." The Sunday of that weekend was my free day. Nobody I knew wanted to go to this famous Jazz Fest, so I went out by myself. I think I even wore a white shirt and a tie. I don't even know what I was expecting. But that afternoon, I would say around 6 p.m., as the sun was starting to crest, I found myself eating my very first soft-shell crab po' boy in my life. Have I mentioned that I'm a Yankee? A native New Yorker, to boot. And the Neville brothers were playing. There was a peculiar perfume wafting through the air. And what I particularly noticed was I was surrounded by literally thousands of people who were having the most fun that I had ever seen people have in my life. Now, again, the North-South thing can be overstated, but as a New Yorker and someone to the art world, I am used to taking my pleasure one sense or perhaps one orifice at a time. This idea that you just cram all of this pleasure into one compound experience was really very, very new to me. So I joined a category which in New Orleans is quite well known. I became a never-lefter, which means I went home to New York from Jazz Fest in 1987, but I never actually really left. Every year from 1987 until this year, I have faithfully returned to New Orleans for Jazz Fest. That's 24 years in running, folks. So I would structure my calendar around needing to be in New Orleans either the last weekend of April or the first weekend of May, or ideally both. Over time, I met everybody in the art world, I met curators, I met artists, and eventually I was drawn a bit into the New Orleans artistic world. In 1995, the same year I went to work for the New Museum, the New Orleans Museum of Art asked me to do the New Orleans Triennial, which has very interesting history because it dates back to the 1880s in the wake of the Cotton and Centennial Exhibition, when New Orleans became, little known fact here, folks, the first city in the United States to program a recurring exhibition of contemporary international art. So beginning at that time, artists such as Edward Manet first showed in the United States through the exhibition, which was an annual Artists Association exhibition. It later morphed into the Delgado Museum annual exhibition. It then became the New Orleans Biennial, and then it became the New Orleans Triennial, and it petered out right around 2004. My relationship with New Orleans was kind of like my mistress, in the sense that I had my life and my career, and I worked very hard, but when I went to New Orleans, I just wanted to blow off steam. I just wanted to have a good time. I didn't really want to be Mr. Curator. I wanted to be Mr. Jazz Fest. And so life went on like that until about 2005. So if I could ask John to lower the lights, I'm going to give you a little bit of background. Well, what is New Orleans? New Orleans, of course, is one of the great port cities of North America. I believe something like 40% of the runoff in the continental United States exits through the Gulf of the Mississippi River. It was a city that was founded partly in order to be easily defended, the French from the Spanish from the English from the Americans from the Spanish. I mean, it was very strategically located, but more than anything else, it was one of the great port cities for trade. New Orleans was one of the wealthiest cities in the United States up until the Civil War. By the 1890s, it had begun to eclipse, but not before opening, for example, the first and the second Grand Opera House in the United States. So many European staples of high culture were introduced to the United States because of New Orleans. You'll see that it's also located squeezed between several large bodies of water, not just the Mississippi River and the Gulf of Mexico, a few miles downriver, but also this large lake, Lake Pontchartrain, that was the site of an ancient Indian portage route that went right through the city of downtown New Orleans. Water, of course, in all of its forms, defines the geography and in many ways the culture and the destiny of New Orleans. The city itself is often described as an island floating in a bowl. If you dig in your yard in New Orleans, you will eventually hit water. Most of the city, well, all of the city is below sea level. And one of the first things that visitors comment on when they come to New Orleans is that when they see the ships passing by on the Mississippi River, they're actually up in the air. This is a typical bayou. The bayou is what New Orleans was carved out of. So draining swamps, ridding the area of pesky mangrove trunks and vines. Spanish moss, of course, is part of the romance of the city. But establishing the city and maintaining the city became a constant struggle against the ever-encroaching element of water, nature attempting to reclaim the land that had been stolen from her gradually over the last 250 years. The 20th century was not kind to New Orleans. Unlike almost any other city in the United States, it shrunk in both population and revenue. A lot of its oil revenue, of course, became diverted and is now known as the city of Houston. A lot of its cultural relationships to Latin America was diverted, and that's now known as Miami. So two super cities grew up in the 20th century, very much at the expense of what New Orleans attempted to do or started out doing, but was not able to maintain as an economy. If you look at the downtown skyline of New Orleans, you realize that it does not have a single distinguished building built after the middle of the 20th century. But you know what? That's not really very important, because what people come to see in New Orleans in terms of architecture is one of the most remarkable historic legacies in the country, which is the largest collection of 19th century domestic architecture in the United States. There are many thousands of buildings built before the 1890s. This is a classic Creole cottage in the French Quarter, dating probably from the 1840s. Although it's often thought of as French architecture, most of these cottages were Spanish in style. The architecture is very closely connected to what you would find in Havana, and even in parts, historic parts of Port-au-Prince, what there is left of it. And indeed, these were the two cities that had the closest cultural connection to New Orleans for much of its glory days. I think it's the architecture and the history that it embodies that draws a great deal of interest to New Orleans today by visitors. But really, the history is probably best communicated through the food of New Orleans. The city is blessed with extraordinary, bountiful, and high-quality shellfish and seafood. The agrarian, the soil in New Orleans is incredibly rich, and so the culinary traditions come from France, they come from Spain and Portugal, they come from Africa, they come from Native American roots, and in many cases, such as this one, Cajun roots, which would be in this case French Canadians, who were expelled from Canada in the 19th century and found their way down the East Coast and into the area which is now around Lafayette, Louisiana. This is, of course, a crawfish boil, one of the staples of New Orleans cuisine around this time of year. It's got a bunch of ingredients all thrown together in a pot and then dumped out unceremoniously onto newspaper, and everyone just goes after it in a very short time. But New Orleans has some of the most important restaurants and chefs in the United States, and I think eating is the source, or fine dining is the source of some of the best tourism, or I should say some of the most dynamic tourism in the city. But most people are smitten by New Orleans' historic culture as it's expressed through its unique musical legacy. Not only was jazz born in New Orleans, most of the great jazz players, certainly the first half of the 20th century, were also born in New Orleans. Rock and roll, funk, zydeco, hip-hop, you cannot name a popular music form that does not trace its roots in some form or another back to New Orleans. I would say that it is far and away the most lively and richest indigenous music scene in the country, and certainly it's the reason why I became a never lefter, because I had to keep returning to New Orleans, not just for the musicianship per se, but because of the intimacy with which music is performed, and the relationship between the musicians and their audience is something quite unlike anything I've ever experienced before or since. A brief word about Mardi Gras, which was a few weeks ago at the beginning of March. Mardi Gras is maybe the carnival season that most distinguishes New Orleans away from the rest of the country. No other city celebrates Mardi Gras in quite the way New Orleans does, certainly, and it becomes a very important point of connection between the city's Catholic culture and its pagan tendencies. The parade season, the amount of beads thrown to people, and especially the symbolic meaning of the accumulation of these beads, which is your material wealth, is then, of course, discarded on the street by midnight Mardi Gras, so that when Ash Wednesday begins and Lent officially marks the season of abstaining from pleasure and luxury, you are as much of a participant by letting go of all this and returning from the world of misrule, which Mardi Gras represents, to the world of normalcy. So, many hundreds of thousands of people's lives were turned upside down by Katrina. As I think many of you probably know, about a fifth of the population left and never came back. And the city was a very, very desolate place for many months towards the end of 2005 and the beginning of 2006. My phone started ringing almost immediately after the floods. Friends who were scattered all over the country were calling me and saying, "Well, look, we know you love New Orleans, and you know we think you also have a great sympathy for the art community here. But really, you need to think about the fact that we don't have any spokespeople right now. Pardon me, we don't have anyone to represent the visual arts community in the same way that the music community has. Wynton Marsalis, Harry Connick Jr., an almost endless list of household names. Would you come down and consider being our spokesperson?" So in January of 2006, about 5 months after the floods, I had my first meeting with a group of about 200 representatives of the visual arts community at the Arthur Roger Gallery. As people like to remember it, they were still digging themselves out at that point, and yet so many people showed up to passionately talk about the cultural rebuilding of the city, and in particular, what the contemporary art world was doing or could do to draw attention to itself. I am a New Yorker, and within a couple of months after Katrina, I became very, very painfully aware of the fact that my own community was becoming very disinterested. They had moved on. They could no longer maintain attention on New Orleans because they didn't understand what New Orleans had to do with them. What was really the connection between the contemporary art world? No famous artists lived in New Orleans. No great collections were formed in New Orleans. The museum was relatively moribund at that state. If you were sitting in your loft or your gallery in Chelsea, you would have thought that New Orleans was as far away as the dark side of the moon. So when I went down, I was not only inspired by the courage and conviction of the local artist community to create something out of their disaster, I was also really struck by how much New Orleans are dedicated to expressing their love of life. There was a little chapbook that was circulating at that time of pictures of people's refrigerators and freezers. I'm sure many of you know why this is the case, but I'm just going to give you a little background information. When you're away from your home for 5 or 6 weeks and there's no electricity and the temperature has crested the 90s or into the low hundreds, when you get back, and when people did get back to New Orleans, they were told in no uncertain terms by public health officials, do not open your refrigerator door. Just get gaffer's tape and seal it up and drag it out to the sidewalk, and they'll pick it up and take it away, and you won't ever have to think about what's going on inside there. And the few people that actually did open up their refrigerators were very, very sorry that they had done so afterwards. But did the refrigerators just sit there on the sidewalk? Of course they didn't. New Orleanians, in the best local spirit, decided to outdo each other in decorating their discarded refrigerators. And so the chapbook that was circulating was really a photograph documenting this process, and that was a very important step for me to tell in developing my own mental process for explaining to the people of New Orleans that yes, I would be happy to take this role on, and that I thought that perhaps the best thing they should do is organize a biennial. They thought that a signature event was the way to go. Several people thought an art fair would be good because Miami was doing so well with their art fair. And I said, well, Miami has collectors, so maybe you don't want to move in that direction. And finally, we decided that the best thing to do was to develop this idea of bringing the world to New Orleans through making the largest international art exhibition in the country. We test marketed a few names for a while, and Prospect New Orleans seemed to be the one that stuck in people's minds the most. I spent a lot of 2006 thinking I would actually do this from New Orleans, but I began to understand that I felt like a carpetbagger to myself, because that would have entailed holding my hand out and trying to get donations for a visual arts organization at the same time that already existing arts organizations in the city were having a very, very hard time just keeping their doors open and the salaries paid of their employees. So by the end of the year, I had some seed money to work with, but it was on the basis that I had to come up with a business plan that would result in an actual biennial actually opening in the city, not just a plan to move in the right direction. That meant opening a little office in Lower Manhattan, starting a company called US Biennial, and I went from a very short time to being an erstwhile curator with a plan to being a cultural entrepreneur running my own not-for-profit organization. We now have offices in both cities, by the way. But almost all of our money was raised outside of the state of Louisiana. So for a $4.5 million biennial, about $3.7 million of that was raised usually in the East and West Coasts, but Texas did their share as well. We opened the week of the weekend of Halloween in 2008, about 4 weeks after Lehman Brothers closed up, and the economy, the bottom started falling out of the economy. Nonetheless, we had 80 artists from 43 countries come to New Orleans and create site-specific exhibitions throughout the city at 24 different sites, and we had more than 50,000 visitors come to New Orleans. Despite the fact that it was free of charge, the direct economic impact for the city over the 11 weeks of the biennial was over $25 million. And the press kit for Prospect is about 2.5 feet high. It's the most press that anyone had ever gotten on a contemporary art project in the United States the year it opened. So part of this idea of developing the biennial meant that we had a short time to work. The seed money that I got was $500,000 from Toby Devin Lewis. I had 18 months to turn that $500,000 to $4.5 million, and I thought, well, I'm going to not do what I would normally do with that amount of money, which is just try to stretch it out as far as I could. I'm going to invest it in fundraising, and I'm going to invest it in marketing. And so we got the word out very, very quickly that we were planning this very ambitious biennial for New Orleans. New York media in particular loved the idea. The New York Times wrote 5 or 6 features about the development of Prospect, including a very lavish and very complimentary review the weekend after it opened. And we found that the notion that New Orleans was rebuilding itself through art was something that appealed not just to general visitors, but in particular to the art world. So that a project like Mark Bradford's, which you'll see in a minute, a three-story Noah's Ark constructed in an abandoned field in the Lower Ninth Ward, was something that was being used by the media to draw people's interest and curiosity about how New Orleans could in fact reinvent itself through making artists the instruments of that redefinition. We decided that the tourism dimension of Prospect was central to its very conception. So all of our marketing and public publicity materials, including the map, which is also a guide. I'm going to quickly show you the back. So that's the flip side. This shows you all of the sites of the exhibition and the artists themselves. But it's based on a very particular way of representing New Orleans, which is looking at the city from across the river. Traditionally, there would have been a balloon floating over on the West Bank looking towards downtown New Orleans. What we did is, what the map makers did is went up in a helicopter and photographed from below the city so that the foreground was the Lower Ninth Ward. The Lower Ninth Ward itself had 13 different projects spread throughout it, and we felt that in a sense it was a venue in and of itself, beyond being a kind of a mass grave, and there's no nice way of putting that. Ringing the image of the city was images of 20 of our 24 venues, including the most august and prestigious cultural institutions in town, right down to an auto repair shop and a furniture store down on St. Claude Avenue, where a lot of the artists were beginning to live and where cooperative galleries were springing up in the months prior to the biennial. The map that we produced not only tells you where to go to find all the different projects in the biennial, it also listed about 65 spaces throughout the city that had their own programming going on during the biennial, and it even listed about 20 spaces that were kind of pop-up galleries during the exhibition. Our idea was to lure people to the city with the promise of great international art, but once they got there, convince them that New Orleans, which indeed at that time had hundreds of contemporary art attractions, to keep them in the city, to stay for longer, to see more. And indeed, many people found themselves racing to see the biennial during the opening weekend and then planning to come back 5 or 6 weeks later to really see it with great detail. So in the time remaining, I want to just walk you through a lot of the projects that were done for the exhibition and then tell you a little bit about what we're doing for Prospect 2, which is opening at the end of October this year. Almost every artist wanted to come to New Orleans, and of course we wanted to bring them there. So the general rule of thumb was that the artist would visit for about a year before the biennial, get to know the city a bit, fall in love with the city, which happened universally, and present us with a proposal for a new work. Some of them were not as directly connected to the flooding or even the city, but they were nonetheless made for the occasion. This is Arnaud Mick, a video artist from Amsterdam, who decided that he wanted to make a long film about disaster sites and a post-disaster social pathology in which people are divided. In this case, they're divided into two groups, passengers at an airport and security. And the passengers sit around twiddling their thumbs, waiting to know what's happening. The security spend most of their time going through exercises, preparing for the passengers to arrive. It never happens. The passengers and security never meet. They kind of stay in their own worlds. And in a way, it became a metaphor for how crisis can push sectors of society apart from one another. The artist Swelatu Umthetwa from Cape Town, South Africa, had never made photographs outside of South Africa, except for a brief series in Madagascar, which he planned to bring to New Orleans. Swelatu was not sufficiently informed. We take responsibility that the Lower Ninth Ward was as bad when he visited it in 2007 as it was right after the storm. The man was traumatized, but he went home and wrote back to us and he said, "I'm ready to make my first photographs outside of Africa. I'm coming back and I'm going to be photographing the Lower Ninth, Chalmette, St. Bernard Parish, New Orleans East." And what he gave us was a series of 14 photographs called Common Ground, in which seven photographs are from squatter camps of migrant workers on the outskirts of Cape Town, and seven of them are from New Orleans. And with a few exceptions, it's almost impossible for the viewer to know what they're looking at, which of these two locations is actually depicted, and I think that was his point. An artist named Skylar Fine became an artist in the wake of Katrina. He was a pre-med student in August of 2005. By October, November, he was an artist. He had come back to the city and decided that he was going to try to heal, not through his hands in a medical way, but through his art. For Prospect One, he developed a very ambitious installation based on the arson fire of the upstairs lounge, a gay bar in the French Quarter, that in 1973 was torched. 37 people died. And when you go into the exhibition, the first thing you encounter is very detailed documentation of these people, these individuals who lost their lives in an episode that was quickly swept under the rug in New Orleans and created a bit of a Stonewall incident. In that the Catholic Church, and New Orleans is overwhelmingly Catholic, would not permit burial or funeral for any of the victims because they were known perverts, so that a service was finally held, but only after weeks of delay. And the demonstrations that happened both inside and outside that church the day of the funeral gave birth to the contemporary gay rights movement in New Orleans. So out of tragedy came a kind of renewal or revision, and you had to go from the room documenting the tragedy through this hallway, passing through the swinging doors under the American flag to step into a reconstruction of this gay bar from 1973 in the deep, deep South. As you can tell, all of the gay icons are actually kind of torn out of mainstream publications, but a lot of people actually found the whole experience of stepping into this time capsule of a lost world as being a very revitalizing influence after Katrina, a reaction that the artist, it's safe to say, was not expecting at all from the public. The New York painter, Jacqueline Humphreys, had grown up in New Orleans moved to New York and become a very successful abstractionist. She asked us for a falling apart industrial space. We found her a 19th century carriage house that had been turned into an auto repair shop, and she did both interventions directly within the space and created installations where abstract paintings were juxtaposed with those interventions. You can see there's a little painting on a sign to the right of the large abstract painting. They were spread throughout the ideal auto repair building with the instructions that the docents and the security for the exhibition could freely move the signs anytime they felt the inclination to do so. The artist John Pilson from New York came down to New Orleans and did a 35-minute film about the city and the different people that he met in New Orleans, called it 1,000 Miles Away, because that's about how far away New York and New Orleans are from each other. In this case, he's gone back into the dispatcher's station at United Cab Company, the largest cab company in New Orleans, which at that time functioned without a single computer. So the way that calls came in and were distributed to the drivers was a fascinating labyrinth of human activity. Caleb Lindsay created a piece, a kind of a serial about miscegenation in the South, and I'm going to actually show you an excerpt of that at the very end of the talk, so I'm not going to spend time on it right now. And Adam Svianovich was one of the artists who followed the lead of Mark Bradford to the Lower Ninth Ward, proposing a wraparound mural of the bayou to cover four rooms of an art center in the Lower Ninth Ward called Tacrima, in which what's depicted is the nature coming back to reclaim the land. If you look out the windows of Tacrima, here it is installed, and in reality, you can actually see in the distance the very same swamps depicted in the wallpaper. So it's both a 19th century tradition of hand-painted wallpaper of landscape and also a very contemporary ecological warning about man's fruitless attempts to conquer and overcome natural forces. The artist Jeanine Antoni from New York had spent a lot of time in New Orleans and also created a sort of oblique reference to the city. She was very interested in destruction at that time and the relationship between destruction and creativity. Just looking around, doing some kind of random research, she discovered that the wrecking ball is now going the way of antiques in this country. Most buildings in the United States are demolished with explosives, so you can't find wrecking balls anymore. She decided to make one, but she had a particular purpose in mind, which was to wreck the wrecking ball. So she made it out of lead alloy, which of course is quite soft. The Johnson Wax Company had this building outside of Binghamton that they needed wrecked. Don't ask me how she found that out, but she got a company to wreck that building, and that was the ball after the wreckage. She recorded the process of wrecking the building and then put herself into a video studio immediately afterwards with headsets, with earphones, transmitting the sound of the demolition to her while her eyeball was being videotaped. So every time the wrecking ball hit the building and there was a boom, she would involuntarily blink. That video was then presented looking at the wrecking ball in a small, darkened corridor at the end of a very large airplane hangar type space in the lower ninth ward, where as you were entering the building, you could hear the demolition, but you didn't know that it was connected to the sound until you entered the space. So no video or no direct documentation of the demolition, just the two orbs, one looking and blinking and the other one showing the sign of the devastation. Leandro Ehrlich from Buenos Aires came to New Orleans and quickly conceived of this project. You're looking at a kind of a demonstration of the work. It's called Too Late, No Escape. A lot of his works are architecturally based sculptures with optical illusions to them. In this case, the idea of a ladder extending down from a window that's been detached from the actual frame of the building that it belongs to, so that it seems to be hanging in midair. He wanted to put that in an open field, but what he wound up doing is putting it quite close to the levees that had breached in 2005. Astride, on the one hand, you can't see it, but to the right of the piece would be the first of the Brad Pitt Make It Right houses, these very futuristic-looking houses that were being built in the lower ninth ward to replace some of the missing buildings. And to its left, as you can see, a home that several years after Katrina is actually still being worked on. So this is kind of typical of the dilemma faced in the neighborhoods where the ongoing process of rehabilitating a house does not necessarily appear to be an ongoing process unless you know what's actually taking place. Ghada Amer, originally from Cairo, now based in New York, wanted to redo a piece that she had done in the south of France called Happily Ever After. This is a sketch for it. This is how it appeared when she put it up just outside of Toulouse in the summer of 2006. Of course, it's the south of France. So the frames that form the letters are growing very, very quickly in the form of flowering vines that then create the letters that surround the circular bench. Down in the lower ninth ward where we were working, of course, we hadn't really counted on the toxicity levels of the soil itself. So even though we did our planting in August, by the beginning of November, we only had about 3 or 4 inches of growth. And by the end of the exhibition in January, even that had died off. But somehow the message was more apt, because Happily Ever After was certainly not what the residents of the lower ninth ward were facing. As I mentioned, Mark Bradford was the first person to go to the lower ninth ward. His father is a native of New Orleans, and he felt immediately after the floods, he said, look, somebody's got to build these people an ark. And when I wrote to him, inviting him to be part of the biennial, he wrote me back in about 5 minutes saying, I'm going to build a 3-story ark for you in New Orleans. And I said, is this Mark Bradford the painter? Because the man hadn't actually milled any sculptures up until that time in his life. Indeed, it was the same Mark Bradford, and we got to work. This is an artist approximation of the work, which was actually built in his studio in South Central Los Angeles. He used construction plywood that retained all of the handbills and posters from the site, rather than being scraped off as it usually is for construction sites. The ark was built around the containers that transported it across country so that they could then be ballast when the piece was finally installed, as you see it here on the lower ninth ward. It was the single most photographed work in New Orleans. In fact, we got a Christmas card shortly after it opened of Robert Greene and his girlfriend Wanda. They were some of our most ardent volunteers in the lower ninth ward. Basically, on the other side of the picture, it says, Happy Holidays from New Orleans. Boats and water, of course, a recurring theme in the artist projects for Prospect. This is Miguel Palma, who kind of retrofitted a Higgins boat. It was a boat developed in South Louisiana for fishing in Bayou Country. It was then adapted by the U.S. Navy to become the primary landing vehicle at Normandy Beach, among other spots in both the European and Pacific theaters in World War II. He turned it into a wave machine. The Higgins boat, as you see it, which was actually built in Portugal and then shipped to us in New Orleans, can only be accessed through these stairs, but they're on pneumatic feet that move very, very gradually up and down, creating a kind of perpetual wave machine so that you don't experience the water as something threatening, you experience it as something healing and calming in the process. The New York artist Nary Ward, originally from Jamaica, sought a church as the site of his intervention, and he looked at several before he came upon the Battleground Baptist Church. Battleground congregation had actually been located in Chalmette on the site of what is today the Battle of New Orleans National Historic Site. They were evicted, moved to the Lower Ninth Ward, and created this church themselves. They have now reestablished the congregation in New Orleans East, but the building was so well constructed in the form of a boat that they ended up being able to restore the entire church and all the woodwork inside, which was exactly the point when Nary approached them. Nary's inspiration was the Reverend Al Sharpton's headquarters, which is about a block away from the artist studio in Harlem. It's a former boxing gym, but now it's used as a community empowerment center. So Nary was very transfixed by this relationship between physical perfection and community development. He created Diamond Gym, a large diamond-shaped sculpture, which is surrounded by four walls that are contain metallic surfaces. They are lit up from the outside and the inside and kind of reflect very brilliantly on the outside walls. There's actually tape of Tina Turner singing Buddhist chants, along with a number of historic African-American priests and religious leaders during the Civil Rights era with their snippets of their sermons woven in and out of that chant. But it's really when you enter the church itself and see the outer walls that the real message of the piece, such as it is, became clear, because he established the first ever community bulletin board in the Lower Ninth Ward, a very important service for a neighborhood that had lost just about 90% of its residents, and those who were there were quite far apart from each other. Very, very few people had internet access. So getting information back and forth and letting people know about services, meetings, various issues had to happen in this old-fashioned bulletin board way. Wageshi Mutu learned the story of Sarah Lasty on her early visits. Sarah Lasty lived right across the street from what is now the L9 Art Center. Her husband was a drummer for Fats Domino, who lived just up the street. Sarah Lasty lost her entire house the very first day of the floods. But even worse, she had insurance and she had road home money, which she turned over to some contractors who poured her an inferior foundation and absconded with all of the money, leaving, of course, no forwarding address. So there was poor Miss Sarah in a one-bedroom apartment in Metairie, far away from her neighborhood, her friends, her family, and broke to boot. So Wageshi, hearing the story, said, "I think I can do something that will be both a sculpture and, in a way, a solution for you." So she created a framework out of just sticks that kind of created a skeleton of the missing house. She strung it with Christmas lights, so every night when it got dark, you'd suddenly see this glowing skeleton. She then made a print. An etching of the idea that was sold at art fairs and through galleries during the year 2009. And by the end of 2009, all the money was there in the Miss Sarah Fund to get the house built. In April of last year, I'm happy to say, just around this time, we dedicated Miss Sarah's house and she moved in, and the house was much better than the one she lived in before. And I noticed that she kept the Prospect One sign leaning against the house just to remind everyone in the neighbor where her beautiful new in the neighborhood where her beautiful new house had come from. Paul Valinsky, a New York sculptor who had been involved in post-Katrina relief efforts in the city, came to New Orleans determined to turn the FEMA trailer, the dreaded FEMA trailer, into a positive symbol. He began thinking about artists and catastrophes, and what he decided to do was transform the FEMA trailer